Chapter 36. Husband Killers. Women who murder their husbands are far rarer than husbands who murder their wives. Why should that be so? The obvious answer is that women are less violent than men. Indeed, a woman is unlikely to experience the same degree of hostility towards her husband unless she is more dominant than he is, or he is thoroughly unsatisfying in bed. This theory is the key to most of the famous cases of husband murder. As recently as 300 years ago, the English regarded husband murder as such a horrible and unnatural crime that they punished it by burning alive. A case that occurred in 1551 became the subject of one of the most popular of early Elizabethan plays, The Anonymous Arden of Faversham. The lady concerned was Alice Arden, sister of Sir Thomas North, who translated Plutarch's Lives. Alice married a Kentish gentleman, Thomas Arden, the mayor of Faversham. It seems likely that Arden desired her for her family connections rather than because he was in love with her. All the evidence shows that he was more interested in money than in sex. After a few dull years of married life, Alice met a tailor named Moresby and became his mistress. Her husband knew about it and didn't care. In fact, he even invited Moresby to come and stay in the house while he was away on business trips. Moresby was perfectly satisfied with this arrangement, but Alice wasn't. With a woman's natural instinct for tidiness, she didn't want to be one man's wife and another's mistress. She may also have found it annoying to satisfy her husband's sexual demands when he came home. At all events, she persuaded Moresby against his will that her husband had to die. Moresby was not the aggressive type, so he approached a man named Green, who had been defrauded of his land by Thomas Arden, and asked him to help. Green, in turn, hired two assassins. As killers, the men were obvious and crude. They simply walked into Arden's house one evening while he was eating his supper and stabbed and throttled him. Moresby then finished him off by hitting him with a flat iron. After that, they dragged the body to a nearby field. The killers had failed to notice it was snowing when they arrived to kill Arden, and the next day peace officers had no difficulty tracing the footprints and bloodstains across the field and back to Arden's house. The murder of a husband by his wife was considered so wicked and scandalous that it was gradually discussed all over England. Alice, her lover, one of the assassins, and two servants who had helped drag the body were all arrested, tried and found guilty. Moresby's sister was also charged with complicity. Alice Arden was then burned alive at Canterbury on March the 14th, 1551. So was the maidservant, crying out on her mistress that had brought her to this end. Moresby and his sister were hanged at Smithfield in London, a manservant was hung in chains at Faversham, and the assassin who was caught was burned alive. Six lives were taken for that of a worthless miser who connived at his wife's infidelity. It was a sign of the horror inspired by husband murder among the Elizabethans. Two centuries later, another case created an even greater sensation and became the subject of innumerable pamphlets and broadsheets. The wife was Catherine Hayes, born Catherine Hall in Birmingham, England. All accounts of the case make it clear that she was a highly dominant female with a powerful sexual appetite. She was only 15 when an army officer persuaded her to leave home. Before long, she had become the mistress of the entire officer's mess. After this exploit, she found a job as a servant with a farmer named Hayes. The farmer's son, John Hayes, fell in love with her, and they were secretly married. Young Hayes was a carpenter, a quiet, easy-going man, dominated by his highly attractive wife, whose descriptions make her sound like an 18th-century Gina Lollobrigida. After 6 years of country life, Catherine was so bored that she insisted that they move to London. There, Hayes became a successful coal merchant and moneylender. Despite, or because of this, Catherine claimed that he was unbearably mean. Their marriage deteriorated steadily. At 35, Catherine felt that she had been cheated out of life. One day, a young man named Thomas Billings came to their house. Catherine declared that he was a relative and insisted that he stay. She lost no time in becoming his mistress. Before long, another Warwickshire friend, Thomas Wood, arrived. Catherine quickly added him to her collection. Then, in the midst of an orgy with her two lovers, she suddenly felt that it was intolerable to have such a mean, if easily fooled, husband. John Hayes was a fairly rich man for those days and a tempting prey. Catherine persuaded her lovers to help her kill him, with a promise of sharing part of his fortune. Accordingly, on March the 1st, 1725, the two men challenged Hayes to a drinking match. When he agreed, they sent for several bottles of wine, and Hayes downed 6 pints of it without considering its potency. The others drank beer. Finally, Hayes staggered off to bed in the next room. Billings came in with a hatchet and hit him a tremendous blow on the back of the head. The dying man struggled so violently that a neighbour from below came up to investigate. Catherine explained that they had noisy guests and promised to keep them quiet. The room was drenched in blood. It was over the bed, the floor, the walls. The young men were thoroughly sickened and unnerved by the sight, and it was their dominant mistress who had to give the orders for the body's disposal. She made them saw off the head with a carving knife, holding it over a bucket to catch the blood. Then the two men went off with the head, concealed under a coat, while Catherine talked in a loud voice for the benefit of the neighbours, pretending that her husband had been suddenly called away on business. The murderers hurried down to the River Thames and discovered that the tide was out. Finally, after discussing various alternatives, they tossed the head from the end of a dock, where it landed on the mud. Then they went back to the house and helped Catherine clean up the blood. Meanwhile, a man had seen them throw something strange-looking into the river. He went to investigate and found the head. He reported his grisly discovery, and the parish officers came to inspect it. Distressed by the mud which disfigured it, they ordered that it should be washed, the hair combed, and then that it should be set upon a stake in St. Margaret's Churchyard in Westminster. A young apprentice who saw it rushed to tell Catherine that the features resembled those of her husband, but she told him angrily that he could get into trouble for spreading false reports. In the meantime, the killers had hacked the body into manageable pieces, put most of them into a trunk, and thrown it into a pond in Marylebone Fields. In spite of the rumours about her husband's disappearance, Catherine Hayes behaved with remarkable coolness. She changed her lodgings, taking her two lovers and the curious neighbour with her, and she went to collect her husband's debts. The head in the churchyard, however, had created too much suspicion for the whole affair to be forgotten. Eventually, a justice of the peace called at her lodgings to make inquiries and came across her in bed with Billings. Together with the neighbour, the lovers were arrested. Catherine was then shown the head, which had been pickled in spirits. Instead of being revolted, she seized it in her hands, crying, "It is my dear husband," and kissed it violently. After that, she fainted. But her histrionics were of no avail. When Wood, who had been in the country, was arrested, his nerve broke and he confessed. At their trial, Wood and Billings were sentenced to be hanged and Catherine to be burned alive. She screamed all the way back to prison. Of the two men, only Billings was hanged. Wood, fortunately for him, perhaps, died of a fever in jail. Catherine's end was as horrible as the one she had inflicted upon her husband. She was due to be strangled before she was burned. However, someone lit the fire too soon, and the hangman jumped back as the flames seared his wrists. Logs of wood were then hurled at the screaming woman to try and knock her unconscious, but without success. It took 3 hours for her body to be reduced to ashes. After Catherine Hayes, most cases of husband killing could be anticlimactic, but in fact the Florence Bravo case has inspired even more literature, including 2 full-length studies and a novel. It took place in 1876, and if the Catherine Hayes case is typical of the brutal 18th century, then the Bravo affair is quintessentially Victorian. It happened in the Priory, Balham, South London, where Charles Bravo, a 30-year-old barrister, lived with his newly married wife, Florence. She was an attractive girl who had been a widow for 4 years when Bravo married her in December 1875. Her first husband, Captain Alexander Lewis Ricardo of the Grenadier Guards, had died of alcoholism, leaving Florence a welcome, and she thought well-earned, £40,000. When Charles Bravo proposed to her, he was aware that she was the mistress of a middle-aged doctor called James Manby Gully, who had tended her when her first marriage was breaking up. Charles's sexual past had not been entirely blameless, so the lovers agreed to put all thoughts of jealousy from their minds. Charles was undoubtedly in love with her, and just as undoubtedly attracted by her money. As she soon discovered, he could be overbearing and bad-tempered. But Florence wasn't the type to be bullied. She had a mind of her own, and a tendency to drink rather too heavily. She ran the Priory, an imposing Gothic pile, with the help of a widow named Mrs. Cox. To begin with, the marriage seemed happy, even though Florence had 2 miscarriages in 4 months, and Bravo suffered from fits of retrospective fury about Gully, and once even struck her. On Friday, April the 21st, 1876, Charles Bravo ate a good supper of whiting, roast lamb, and anchovy eggs on toast, washing it down with burgundy. Florence and Mrs. Cox drank almost 2 bottles of sherry between them. At 10 that night, loud groans came from Bravo's bedroom. He had been seized with severe abdominal pains and began vomiting. He vomited for 3 days until he died. Sir William Gull, Queen Victoria's physician, who was suspected by some 20th century criminologists of being Jack the Ripper, saw him before he died and gave his opinion that Bravo was suffering from some irritant poison. A post-mortem confirmed this. There were signs of antimony poisoning. At this point, Mrs. Cox declared that Bravo had told her, "I have taken poison, don't tell Florence." An open verdict was returned at the inquest, but the newspapers smelled scandal and openly hinted that Florence had killed her husband. Another inquest was held, prompted by Charles's brother, Joseph, who was out to get a verdict of willful murder, which would lead to Florence's arrest. This time, the Dr. Gully scandal came into open court, doing Gully a great deal of professional damage. Added to this, a dismissed servant of the Bravos testified that he had once bought tartar emetic for the doctor. But again, the jury decided that there was not enough evidence to charge anyone, although they agreed that it was a case of murder. So Florence was exculpated, and she died of alcoholism 2 years later in Southsea. Ever since then, students of crime have argued about the case. The most popular theory, obviously, is that Florence did it. An inquest on the body of her first husband, conducted after the Bravo inquest, showed traces of antimony in his organs. However, Ricardo had by then been separated from Florence for months. It seems possible that his violent attacks of vomiting were not due to alcoholism, but to slow poisoning with antimony. But why should Florence kill her husband? Possibly because he insisted on his marital rights and she was terrified of further miscarriages. Possibly because she came to realise that he was interested only in her money. In How Charles Bravo Died, the author Isolde Bridges suggests that Bravo accidentally took the poison with which he had been dosing Florence. Crime novelist Agatha Christie believes that Dr. Gully did it or helped Florence do it. Many other writers believe Mrs. Cox was the culprit. Bravo disliked her and is known to have wanted to get rid of her. The Priory has now been turned into working-class flats and has a reputation for being haunted, but no one has ever produced a satisfactory explanation of the mystery of Bravo's death. The two classic cases of husband murder in the 20th century, Ruth Snyder and Edith Thompson, show this same pattern of the dominant woman. Since Granite Woman Snyder died in 1928, the United States has added at least one more classic to the list, Cora McCown of Virginia. On January the 8th, 1969, the police of Chesapeake, Virginia, learned of the disappearance of Tim McCown, an ex-Marine, recently back from Vietnam. His wife, Cora, explained that he had vanished after a quarrel 2 days before. She mentioned coyly that her husband had been in the habit of trying to excite her by beating her with a leather belt before sex, and she pulled up her miniskirt to show bruises on her thighs. The police then broadcast inquiries about the missing man, with no result. Cora, a beautiful 22-year-old with a sultry mouth, kept in touch with her investigations and reported one day that she had just received a monthly statement from a credit card firm showing that someone had signed her husband's name to garage bills. The bills included the numbers of two cars. The owners were traced and were baffled. They still had their cars, and they denied signing the bills in Tim McCown's name. A short while later, in March, a man noticed something floating in the Elizabeth River at Portsmouth, Virginia. The moment he recognised a human foot sticking out from the bundle, he called the police. It proved to be a headless and handless corpse wrapped in a plaid quilt. Death was due to stab wounds in the chest. One of the policemen who was working on the disappearance of Tim McCown realised that the corpse had been found opposite a house where he had conducted inquiries about McCown's credit card. He had talked there to a young housewife named Judy Clear. The same investigator had since heard rumours that a dark, good-looking man had been calling on Cora McCown. His description matched that of Henry Clear, Judy's husband. Clear had a criminal record and was now on bail for theft and impersonating a police officer. It was at this point that Cora McCown appeared, asking to see the quilt in which the corpse had been wrapped. When it was shown to her, she declared that it looked exactly like a quilt she had been given for a wedding present. She was taken to see the corpse and confirmed the police suspicion that it was her husband when she mentioned that he had a mole on his left thigh. A chunk of flesh from the left thigh had been hacked away. In spite of her attempts to behave like an innocent person, Cora was the obvious suspect. For if her husband's body had been mutilated to disguise his identity, the murderer must have been someone who had a forceful motive for doing this, someone who knew him. When the police confronted her with Henry Clear, she broke down and admitted to the murder of her husband. In her first confession, she claimed that she alone had stabbed Tim after a quarrel. Then, she continued emotionally, she had dragged his body into his car and driven it into the river at the waterfront. However, she refused to sign this confession and made another, in which she alleged that it was clear who had murdered her husband without any cooperation on her part. Cora was the first to be brought to trial in August 1969. She repeated her story about Tim being a sexual sadist. However, some of her admissions at the trial firmly indicated that she had masochistic tendencies. Asked whether she had had intercourse with other men beside Clear, she explained demurely that she had been raped by four different men, three of them friends of her husband. She also admitted to having had an affair with an insurance man who had sold her a $10,000 policy on her husband's life. The jury found her guilty of murder, and she was sentenced to life imprisonment, a minimum of 15 years. 3 months later, at the trial of Henry Clear, she admitted in court that her husband beat her with a belt because he knew it excited me. The prosecuting attorney pointed out that she had talked about how much she hated the beatings during the course of her own trial. Cora explained that none of that is real to me anymore. Her lover was then sentenced to die in the electric chair. But it would be inaccurate to imply that all husband killers have a touch of nymphomania. Study of the case histories shows that they fall into two well-defined groups, the young and highly sexed women and the drab, middle-aged matrons who, for various reasons, are disenchanted with marriage. In this latter category was Mrs. Beatrice Pace of Gloucestershire, England, the wife of a shepherd who beat her. When Harry Pace died of arsenic poisoning in January 1928, she was charged with his murder. The defence contended that Pace died accidentally by getting sheep dip, which contains arsenic, on his moustache. The prosecution pointed out that this hardly accounted for the 10 grains of arsenic found in his stomach. Nevertheless, the judge agreed with the defence's submission that there was no case to go before the jury, and the trial was stopped. There was strong sympathy for Mrs. Pace, who had obviously lived a life of misery with a man whose fits of violence could be terrifying. Mrs. Helen Bartlett also fits into this second group. Widowed in 1940, she met Alfred Babin in Buffalo, New York, and married him during the war. Babin was a heavy drinker. One day in 1956, Mrs. Babin called the police. Her husband was lying face down in his bath, dead. She declared that he had drunk a full quart of whiskey before taking a bath, and analysis of his stomach showed this to be true. Mrs. Babin benefited to the extent of $69,000 of insurance. Not long afterwards, she met a 69-year-old patient at the Veterans Hospital where she worked, Wright Bartlett, who had 100% war disability pension. The couple married in 1959, and the new Mrs. Bartlett proposed taking a long honeymoon in Florida and in Texas. It was after they had left in her car that an insurance company had the ghost of a suspicion. She had insured Bartlett for $10,000 and then tried to take out a second insurance on him. Investigators checked with other companies and quickly discovered that Wright Bartlett was now insured for a total of $110,000. The police began a frantic but fruitless search for the honeymooners. A few months later, however, they returned of their own accord to Buffalo. Bartlett was looking sick and half-starved, the result, he said, of eating sandwiches on their travels instead of hot meals. At first, Mrs. Bartlett indignantly denied that she had intended to kill him or had killed anyone else. Then, under long police questioning, she suddenly broke down and admitted that she had held Alfred Babin's head underwater until he had drowned.